Next, a recording of this month's Happy Hour with the Historian at the St. Petersburg Museum of History, a presentation from Bob Keeling, the author of How the Beatles Rocked Florida, recorded at the museum on April 13th.
My name is Natalie Vincente, and I am the broker and owner of Southern Roots Realty, which is a local boutique real estate firm here in St. Petersburg. We are so excited to be the presenting sponsor of Happy Hour with the Historian for this entire year in 2023, and we hope that you will join us for every event coming up. We have some really great speakers and great topics in the next couple months, so please take part in those. The History Museum is very important to me and my family. I am actually a third generation native of St. Pete, and my husband is a fifth generation native. So the stories of old Florida have always been important. I also served on the museum's board for 7 years and continue to do different things on committees and different projects that we have here. The museum has always been a great community partner to help us educate visitors and residents in our city, and the Happy Hour with the Historian is just one way that the museum shares our past and how it shapes our present and our future. So please feel free to bring friends, neighbors, people you meet on the street to these great events here, because it just helps educate our community and help our community grow. This month we are so excited to have Bob Keeling here and speak about one of probably my parents' favorite topics, which is the Beatles. Even though I am not from that generation, I grew up listening to them on a daily basis, and we are very excited to hear all of your stories. So thank you so much, and thank you all for attending tonight.
Thank you, Natalie. I forgot to mention, I wanted to highlight a new partnership that we just signed. We just signed an agreement with the Vinoy, the historic Vinoy. And if you've not seen the renovations, you've got to go check it out. They're absolutely fantastic. So we're going to be doing a number of events there, as they will be doing events here. So you'll be reading about that in our newsletters going forward. So tonight's talk, I've been waiting 2 years for tonight's talk. When Bob first mentioned it, he was thinking of writing a book about the Beatles, because I'm gonna say the same thing Natalie did, even though it's not true, that they're not my generational music, but yeah. I grew up with the Beatles. I taught for 20 years at St. Pete High teaching 60s history, so you can't teach that without teaching the Beatles in that class. So I've been waiting a long time for this talk. So tonight's speaker is no stranger to the Museum of History. He's delighted us with stories of Jack Kerouac's adventures in Florida, Brownie Wise and how she built the Tupperware Empire, and of course, how Elvis Presley's, how he rose to fame and fortune here in Florida. He is an Edward R. Murrow and four-time Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist, an author, a historic preservationist, co-founder of the Jack Kerouac Writer in Residence Project of Orlando, but most importantly, a master storyteller. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Keeling.
Thank you all. And before I get going, could you join me in thanking once again our very generous sponsors, as well as Rui and his hardworking team. And I'm going to kind of pace around here like a caged animal, so don't mind me. And I wanted to say thanks to all the Swifties who turned out tonight. I thought a Swiftie was like a dust mop. Or is it some kind of a soft-serve dessert? A kind of chocolate and vanilla Swiftie, if you will. You know, interesting story, Rui told me that Taylor Swift's first appearance here in St. Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, was right down there at the end of the pier, in the snack bar area. So she's the one laughing last. She's like, yeah, I'm a Swiftie. But it kind of reminds me of the curmudgeon way that the Beatles were received when they first came to the United States. Recently, I saw a Newsweek magazine cover that just had all of their hair. You know, all of them, and they were just very dismissive and, you know, mop head this and blah, blah, blah. Does anybody read Newsweek anymore? I don't think so. So, okay, well, once in a while. You know, this book was an absolute joy. One of my favorite things as a journalist is the journey. It's meeting all of the people involved with this. So what I'm going to do is I've got this slideshow, and obviously I'm not going to tell you the whole story because I want you to buy the book. Okay, that's why I'm here. You know, not great people, but this was absolute joy. Just look at the cover. Look at it. These are guys who had toiled in relative anonymity on the Reaper Bond in Hamburg. So you can imagine, here's George, he's all 20, and he's got this, oh gosh, look on his face. He wasn't that kind of guy. He was the serious one in the group. And all of them are here in Florida with just such unmitigated joy. You know, the first couple of cities they were in when they first came to America was New York, where they were practically prisoners in their hotel. Then they played D.C. They're on a train, it's snowed in, it's awful. Then they come to Florida. They come to Florida. And I argue this is where they fell in love with America. First time in the ocean, first time beaches. Paul McCartney said, it's the first time we've ever seen palm trees. Yeah. Those herbs you were looking at, Paul. And here he is. This was at Camping World Stadium. God, less than a year ago. That's Paul. That's Paul McCartney, aka one of the Beatles. And I'll bring this all circle for you at the end of the slideshow, but I want you to remember that picture. This one here is kind of a doofus-looking guy. But he's got gloves on, so that must be, you know, something pretty cool. This is actually the Hard Rock Vault. When it was in this nondescript building in Metro West in Orlando. And I'm holding all of this ephemera tied to the Beatles' visit in 1964. And this is a four-page letter from Paul McCartney to their bodyguard. And I think that's so wonderful. It's Paul's scrawl, and it's got the address there in North Miami Beach. And really building blocks to this story are these great everyday folks who had these wonderful encounters with the Beatles. This is one of the most beautiful sets of autographs the band have ever seen. So here's background on this. You know, they get picked up by a limo driver at the airport in Miami. And it's funny too, because the tag for his assignment to the Beatles, BEETLES. Well, they were new. You know, they were new. So, you know, you just say, hey, boys, can you sign this business card? I think this is actually the first autograph they all signed in Florida. So this guy down in Queen City told me about having it, and he knew it was very precious. I think he paid $100 for it, which is a hell of a bargain. But he wasn't sure what it was worth, you know, he wanted to get it back. So he sends it away to get value. Guess what happened? Never came back. So I'm thinking maybe somebody somewhere out there will have seen this and gone, ah. But I realize the chances are pretty slim, but what a great autograph. Yeah. And probably the first one they signed as a group in Florida in 1964. So let's have a little trivia, shall we? Now, I want you guys to participate. When I was a kid growing up, youngest of six, you know, my sister had all the great Beatles vinyl, all of that. But I was never quite sure what was the big song that broke it big for them. I always thought of two songs.
I Wanna Hold Your Hand.
Well, there's I Wanna Hold Your Hand, but there's also She Loves You. So let's have a show of hands. Who thinks the breakthrough single was I Wanna Hold Your Hand? And if you've read the book, you're cheating. And how many of you think it was She Loves You? It's about half and half. Well, you're kind of both right. The first single that was released in America for the Beatles was She Loves You, only it was on the Tiny Swan label and it bombed. The big song that the girls are all freaking out about is I Wanna Hold Your Hand. And that was the song. Yeah, that is that song. That's the one that blew it open for them. And so one of the important things. Come on, baby.
I'm coming.
Oh, this is just killing me.
When a cool guy comes to text you.
There you go.
All right, it's happy hour. We're in no hurry.
Great.
So this fella is John Frusty. And he's a Navy man. He met the Beatles in Key West, and that's all cool. And you'll see that in the story. But there were a couple of occasions of synchronicity along the way. You know, events seem totally disconnected till they're not. And I had one of these with John. I took a call on him, we're doing an interview, yeah, they were making small talk, he's outside Chicago. He was like, Bob, where are you from? I said, I'm from this little bedroom community north of Orlando called Longwood. He goes, oh, Longwood? My sister lives in Longwood. I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And he goes, have you ever heard of Needles Trail by any chance? I said, John, I live on Needles Court. It turns out his sister's grandson used to cut my grass. Isn't that strange? So as I'm doing the interview with him, he kind of mentions his first time hearing, I want to hold your hand. And I'd like to do this reading for you because it is just so compelling and so visual. And when I heard him say it, I thought, okay, now I've got the beginning to my book. Along the dark outskirts of Homewood, Illinois, a 1957 Buick, the long and rangy gas-guzzling kind with the sleek lines, barreled down the interstate. All alone, behind the wheel, a young crew-cut Navy man nursed a healthy beer buzz and hauled ass. He's probably at the happy hour too somewhere, right? Drunk Trusty was in transit, having just finished hospital corpsman school in San Diego. In the midst of 30 days home leave near the Windy City, Trusty was preparing to head south to Florida and his assignment at the Naval Air Station Hospital in Key West to pass the time, stay awake, and keep his brother-in-law's car from ending up in a snowy ditch. He switched on the radio to 89 WLS AM, the bright sound of Chicago radio. And in the wee hours of this frigid night, an urgent, unfamiliar beat hit him like a blast of wind. Oh yeah, I tell you something, I think you'll understand. You don't want me to say The music blasting from Trusty's car radio that frigid night was akin to an awakening. During the saddest of holiday seasons, post-JFK, dear God, could we say it was joyous. Hearing I Want to Hold Your Hand for the first time on that deserted, snow-blown stretch of interstate, John Trusty picked up on the vibe immediately. And then, admittedly, he did something stupid. I actually started doing donuts on the four-lane highway. I was so happy, he marveled. I don't know, I can't say why. I heard it and just, wow, this shit is good. In this dream flight of time and imagination, we're witnessing a youth's visceral reaction to music of his generation. Watching from a drone's eye above, 2 tons of American steel on 4 wheels swirl round and round, just like an old school 45 RPM single on a kid's portable record player. At a pivotal moment in time, musically, culturally, and politically, America's youth were meeting the Beatles, their new North Stars, one DJ, one radio, one record player at a time. Oh, yes. Thank you. Taylor Swift would be proud. That was such a smooth transaction. That was a Swifty transaction. So that's John's story. And actually, after that vivid, lyrical description of hearing I Want to Hold Your Hand for the first time, he ends up down in Key West with the Beatles. on their tour, and it was wonderful. You can't tell the story of the Beatles' time in 1964 Florida without including the African-American experience. And Kitty Oliver was an amazing interview. She had noticed the Beatles because she had seen pictures in teen magazines like this. They look unusual? It does? Why does it look unusual? 62, 63, look at that. Touching, all of that. But to her, that wasn't necessarily the point. She just talked about how the harmonies actually reminded her of like the Ronettes. And she and her friend would dance late at night, you know, and when her mom went to bed, she'd listen to Wait the Big Ape in Jacksonville and listen to the Beatles. And she became a very important figure in the Florida story because she was one of a handful of African Americans who actually ventured out and saw them at the Gator Bowl after there had been an issue about whether or not the Gator Bowl would be segregated or not. It was not. It was integrated. Hang on. Okay. So, here's some more of the building blocks of the book. And I could not have found a better character than this guy. Sergeant Buddy Dresner of the Miami Beach Police Department. He was working nights. Okay? And gets a loud knock on the door. And believe me, you know, any of y'all work nights? You gotta sleep by day like a vampire? So when somebody wakes you up, you're not the best friend. And so he grouses through the door. It's a fellow cop. He's like, what the hell do you want? And they say, you are going to be assigned to the Beatles security. You're the head
of the Beatles security detail.
And he says, okay, what is Beatles? He had no idea. Until he saw them.
And saw them?
The coverage of them arriving at JFK, where there were 200 police officers assigned. And he's looking at that and he's going, our agency only has 60 cops. This Beatles book is a great research tool. They would come out monthly for all the fans. And here they are clowning around at Buddy's house. Paul's got his service revolver out. Can you imagine? I think his chief might have an issue with that. But it was wonderful because Buddy had this light touch about him where he could be authoritative. He could be like the father figure, the uncle, the big brother. He was a funny guy too. And it ended up that he was the security guy for Elvis and Bob Dylan and the Monkees, so obviously he was doing something right. Now remember when we talked about synchronicity? You don't? Where are you at? Oh, it's because I don't talk loud enough. Anybody recognize this lady? Anybody remember the Trayvon Martin case? George Zimmerman trial? That's Judge Deborah Nelson from that case. But that's not why she called me at home one weekend. So, I told you about all of the memorabilia I had access to in the Hard Rock collection. And their archivist had this cool thing he does, he could stream it. It was called Memorabilia Monday. So we're on there, you know, talking about the different stuff. And she goes, I saw you on that, and I had something I wanted to share with you. And again, I'm still stunned. I'm like, well, Judge, this is one of my, Your Honor. She's like, call me Debbie. Your Aunt Debbie. She goes, I was Buddy Dresner's next door neighbor. I was his next door neighbor. And when they came over to his house for their first home cooked American meal in America, the little neighbor girl had figured it out. She goes, well, it was all I could do. Across the street, I got the window. House. Finally, after dinner, she got up the courage to knock on the door, and they invited her in for dessert. to the judge from the Trayvon Martin case, had dessert with the Beagle. And if you don't believe me, that's the card they signed for her in 1964. Now you're going to remember synchronicity. This was another great one. You guys all remember this picture? No. We got a contrarian over here. You were a kid, so was I. I know. This was actually for the 20th anniversary of the British invasion. They finally put it on the cover. I was lucky enough to interview all five members of the Life magazine team who made this happen with great effort. This lady in the middle, the reason why she looks so happy is her name is Dale Cameron. She was the reporter for Life magazine. And she had been with the Beagles in New York. And she's at JFK, and she gets whisked into a limo, picked up by a cop out of the shoe, because it's so much hysteria. Then this guy gets thrown into the limo too, and it's Ringo. And poor Dale goes, the cop, he lifted me up. He lifted me out of my shoes. I don't have my shoes. And Ringo, who has just encountered this woman, you get the shoes, love. This is John Lowengar, who took this iconic picture. It was so difficult to get to him. So difficult. I sent him an email. And an hour later, he said, sure, what can I do? Isn't that amazing? You know, you think this research is going to be so hard and these people don't want to talk to you. Not at all. They want to share their story. And he goes, yeah, you know, I had this idea of this real sexy Grace Kelly picture that had been in Life and blah, blah, blah. He goes, then I get these pasty skin English guys. He thought the picture stunk. He goes, yeah, this is kind of a third rate, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, but you know, I started to rethink it when one of my daughter's teenage friends said, can I hold your hand just because you took that picture? What a thrill. There they are in this family's backyard pool on this same day. And Gail was telling me the story. My editors, after they came to New York, they said, we want you to get on a plane to Miami and let's get them in a swimming pool with wet hair. And then the rest was up to her. She's on the plane flying down with the Beatles trying to figure out, okay, what the hell am I going to do now? But fortunately, there was a couple of very enterprising people who worked in their Miami bureau who were able to come up with the pool. And then it was up to Gail to convince the Beatles to do it. She's the most fascinating person. So I'm up on the 12th floor of the Deauville Hotel pleading with him. You know, because they thought after they did the Sullivan show, they were going to be on vacation. And finally, okay, love, we'll do it. And as I said in the book, for the kind of readership that Life magazine had, tens of millions of people, you all remember, you used to, you know, fight to get the first look at it. I said Brian Epstein would have made them jump into a pool of molten lava for that kind of coverage. So there's Ed with the grandsons. Here's the girls. There's the boys. I interviewed this kid, Rob Precht, who's an attorney now up in New York. He said, if that's for me, I'm not. He said, standing just a few feet from the Beatles during the rehearsal, he said, that music is burned into my soul. That's what it meant to him. And he said, our family would get so nervous before they're doing a remote like this. They stayed at the Font Blue. They watched it on TV, Ed's own family. Because what they did with the Beatles, you know, we always hear about the first Sullivan performance from the Ed Sullivan Theater. Okay, well, that was a big deal. I would argue this was a much bigger deal. The second live. from a working beach resort in Miami. I mean, all the lighting and everything, the power grid was going out, people got mad they couldn't get in, so they called it a bomb threat. And yet the show still went on. So I say that this was a far more difficult thing to do, being live at this resort. So after they do the Sullivan Show, and it comes out great, 70 million viewers watched Uncle Ed and the boys, and as I said before, we all convened here, it put them in the rarefied ratings air along with the Beverly Hillbillies. So you know it was a big deal. So here they are. They decided after being on Sullivan, they love Miami so much, they're gonna stay another week. And their security guard buddy Dresden is like, what the hell are you talking about? Now, Brian Epstein left with the money. He went on back to England. So now it's up to the money to figure out what the hell to do with these guys. So one of the things they did on the Tuesday after Sullivan performance is they went and met this brash kid named Cassius Clay. And this was a week before he beat Sonny Liston to win the world title. And I was lucky enough to interview a New York Times writer by the name of Robert Lipsight, who was actually with the Beatles in Clay's locker room before he came in. And the Beatles were not happy. They're like, who is this wanker? Who's gonna lose? You know, this big mouth and all of that. And, you know, Lipsight's trying to keep things light. And then the door flies open. And this chiseled guy comes in, towering over them. He's got this look on his face. Hey, Beatles, let's go make some money. And immediately, Lipsight said, it was just like all the angst was gone. And they had this wonderful performance, slapstick, this photo bomb. And you know, Robert said to him, this was almost like really the beginning of the 60s, when you consider how culturally significant these five people were. And after Ali won the world title for Clay at that time, recognize him?
Yeah.
That's Malcolm X. They had been recruiting Clay, soon to be Ali, to join the Muslim Nation. It's just part of this mountain, this hot boiler that was 1964 Florida. There was just so much going on. So let's talk about their influence. I want to stop for a second. The book is split up in three parts. Innocence, which is them coming to America, falling in love. Influence, on guys like this kid with the bad Beatles wig. And then the last section of the book is activism, which carries a lot of topics like you saw in the civil rights display, because the Beatles are right in the middle of it. So here's little Tom Petty. Here it is with the Sundowners. 13 years old. He had to wear that wig because his dad was a hard-ass insurance guy. Didn't want to play in that sissy music. And that led to some real friction. But yeah, Petty said, you know, he had had a chance to have an encounter with Elvis on the set of Follow That Dream in 61 in Ocala because his uncle was a prop master. That was one thing. Remember, Elvis was Elvis. And Petty's just some little kid. But when he sees the Beatles, he realizes, okay, these guys are succeeding as a collective without necessarily a defined star. And he said that was a big turning point to him. And after that, he said, seeing the Beatles was like, you know, America, everything, going from black and white to color. It was a seismic moment for him and so many others. And this influence part is about this amazing fraternity of Florida Rock and Roll Hall of Famers who followed in the wake of the British invasion. And that can't be understated. I talked to a guy who went to a Rolling Stones concert with Ronnie Van Zant and Lynyrd Skynyrd in his red 65 Mustang. And for Skynyrd, it was the Beatles, but it was also the Stones. And that was the week that Keith dreamed the riff, the Satisfaction, in Clearwater. He wrote that song that very week. So the Beatles started this, literally the British invasion. Nobody had succeeded. Cliff Richard and the Shadows sunk like a stone. And they were popular in England. But it was the Beatles that broke it wide open. And, you know, Petty followed that formula to great fame and fortune. But there were a lot of sacrifices. And one of my great sources in the book, unfortunately, just passed away a few weeks ago, Tom Ledden. He's that big tall fella. He was Tom's first lead guitarist and brother in arms. And you can see the handbill. Their band, Mud Crutch, would have these free farm festivals out on Mud Crutch Farm in Alachua County. You see the opening act? Man, Skinner, not bad. Now, this was at the University Auditorium, and admission's a whole dollar. But I'll tell you on a serious note, this was a time when Tom was really ruthless. They had seen the Allman Brothers Band come to this Battle of the Bands in Gainesville in 69, this monster six-piece, integrated band, two lead guitarists, and they're still playing Beatle covers. I said, now is the time. We've really got to kick this into gear. And you see, Tom, he's looking in pretty bad shape. And his best friend's sister told me that at one point when she saw Petty, she asked her mom, she said, you think Tommy's on drugs? This one ever see Mike Campbell? He went on to be Petty's brother-in-arms and, you know, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and all that. But Tom Ledden told me at one point it got so bad between Petty and his dad, saying, listen, you can't do this stuff. You're a long-haired hippie. His dad chased him out of the house at gunpoint. So, I mean, there was a lot of sacrifice that went on. And I bet he's, you know, these formative years very compelling because, you know, Tom told me about getting started. And he and Tom deconstructing the songs and figuring out what kind of gear they played. And so these guys, he said, from afar, George Harrison was our first guitar guru. No question about it. And to think, this poor kid, whose dad chased him out of the house at gunpoint, ended up becoming a bandmate with one of the people in the Traveling Wheelbarrows. Okay, so this is the third section of the book I was talking about. This guy, Larry Payne, is fantastic. He was a 21-year-old radio reporter in Miami when the Beatles came. He's a serious news guy. And he does not want to be assigned to covering some little teeny bopper band. You know, we got Cuban refugees. We got civil rights. I don't want to do this. Then, is he standing at the Miami airport when they first get here on February 13, 1964. He's standing on the tarmac. And the kids are pushing so hard against the bottom windows. One comes down and like crashes right near his feet. And he realizes, okay, maybe there is something to this. You're so intuitive about young girls' reaction, too. You know, think about 1963, 64. Wasn't it kind of frowned upon for young girls to be screaming and yelling? And, you know, the Beatles changed things. And Larry asked for an interview with the Beatles when they come back to Jacksonville in September. That's what he asked for. And he gets a letter in the mail from Brian Epstein saying, we'd love to have you come with us on the entire North American tour. And he says, oh my God, the access. But the problem was his mother was dying of MS. And he had this heart-wrenching conversation with his parents. And it was his mom who said, you should go. This assignment will change your life. And it sure as hell did. And the first time, I'm gonna be diplomatic about this because John Lennon never was. When Larry goes rolling into the hotel room in San Francisco, Lennon looks him up and down, Larry's disheveled, he's, you know, traveling all across country, he's got a big old tape recorder. Lennon looks him up and down and goes, why are you dressed like a queer? Now, how would you respond to that? And Larry was very intuitive, because he said, you know, if I tell John Lennon to F off. I can forget my whole assignment. So what he did was, after he was able to calm down, he interviewed the other Beatles, and comes back to John and says, what do you think about the U.S. escalation in Vietnam? And nobody's asking those kind of questions. And Larry Kane was the one who asked him about the very real likelihood that the upcoming concert at the Gator Bowl would be segregated. And it was Paul, to his credit,
who said,
we don't do that. We do not understand why, back then they called them colored people, why they're treated like animals or something. That's the word that Paul used. And he said, you know, if it's segregated, we're not going to play there. So they took a very strong stand. There was a line in the sand. These guys were still new, and this was a risky move. But some things happened in the courts before they got to Jacksonville, which changed everything. And one of the things, can you believe that? I don't know if you all saw the picture in the exhibit. It is taken from this side of the car. Andrew Young, MLK. So this was after he was arrested in St. Augustine at the Monson Motor Lodge. And the judge decided they would send him up to Jacksonville for safekeeping. So he was held in solitary confinement. And then there was a very important court hearing up there by a judge named Brian Simpson. And his ruling started the dominoes falling for the Civil Rights Act. And it was really something. I had a federal judge in Orlando have his staff unearth this transcript from the hearing. And the judge is like, your name is Dr. King again. Is that Reverend King and all that? And it's just amazing. Look at these iconic figures. But that judge's rulings were absolutely crucial. Take a look at this. This is the Beatles on their first tour. But see, I mean, they had African Americans opening for them. And I interviewed this lady, Lillian Walker Moss of the Exciters. And then that big guy back there is Reggie Young, who was with the Bill Black combo. And they gave me a first person account of what it was like on this tour. And they actually said the worst racism that happened in Denver, which is surprising. But this was a very climactic tour. This is another famous reporter that I quoted quite a bit. A lot of just iconic figures. This was their PR guy. Ivan Davis is the name of that reporter. He's quite a bit of a book. He's very good. So this was their first North American tour that started in August of 64 and went all over North America. So they get to Montreal. And some extremist group decides that Ringo's Jewish. Then they start making netherites on him. So after, he's like, I'm not Jewish, but this dude's doing it anyway. And so after the show in Montreal, they decided, let's get the hell out of here. They had a couple of days off, so they flew all night to Key West, to that very resort right there. Look at that, it's 3 o'clock in the morning when they land in Key West. Kids up on the roof of the airport. But it was just amazing. This is the Key Western Resort. This right here is the little cabana where they all stayed. This is the only building left in Florida where we can say that the Beatles slept. It's the only one. There were two very climactic days. Playing there. They just had finances. And it was Larry Kane's idea to fly down there because, you know, the kids did get tipped off they were coming, but for other kids to come from the mainland, it would take a 3 or 4 hour drive. So at least they had a little bit of peace and quiet in this resort right next to the airport. Here's John and Keith in the Keys. He actually was wearing civilian clothes because he was part of a photo shoot for Cosmo magazine. And this enterprising green horn reporter named Gloria Steinem has decided that John is the one that has staying power to be a solo star. He's the one Beatle that we think, I have staying power. So that's why John was dressed like that, and it was fun to read about them locking the doors of his clothing place on Duval Street.
For him to go shopping.
This was one of my favorite interviews right here. Lofton Coffee Butler. Anybody ever heard of him? You ever go to Key West? Wonderful blues singer. And when the word was out, you know, he's a piano player, performed for President Truman. When the word got out, he told me, he said, "So my manager, Herb Rosenberg, called out to the Key Wester and said, 'I got a black beetle I want you boys to meet.'" And he was great. He still remembers just the stage jamming with Ringo and George and the grandstand. He goes, "I remember the first song was definitely Blueberry Hill. Now the second one I can't quite remember. But at 4 a.m, they finally shut us down. And he said, Ringo told them, 'Let the man play.'" That was great. We sat in a nice chat. This was during COVID, so I got one of those big, because I sure as heck was not gonna, you know, take a chance of infecting his Key West treasure. But what a great guy. And everybody in Key West knows Coffee Butler. So after all this worry about, is it going to be integrated, you know, is the Klan going to show up? The only problem was the weather. You know why their hair is blowing like that? Remember what happened? Hurricane Dora. That's the other reason why the Beatles took a detour and went all the way to Key West. So Dora could blast him through. But the great thing was, even after all the flooding in the house, they buried the power lines to the stadium, to the head power. The stadium itself was not, you know, badly damaged. So Ringo said, "I'm not getting up on that bloody riser unless you build a banister." So that's why they built that, because he was afraid he was going to blow away. But hey, that was the worst thing, right? And the concert went off pretty much without incident. And that was the one and only time the Beatles played live in concert and not for a TV show in Florida, September 11th of 64, at the Gator Bowl. Now, you remember that picture I told you about? This is Paul's car coming in less than a year ago to Camping World Stadium. I just want to tease you guys as I tell you exactly what happened. But it was wonderful to witness and be there with all of these Beatle groupie folks. He drives by, pulls down the window. This little girl's not my daughter's age. He stopped and he looked at her and waved right at her. She missed her senior prom in Mexico to come. This girl, lady, this is all Beatles stuff and a tattoo on her arm. And you know, it just, I was able to see Ringo and Paul in the last few years and have wonderful encounters with them that you'll read about in the book, Swifties. The conclusion was, Beatlemania is alive and well. 60 years later, this little girl, Paul just waved at her, tears coming down her face. And like I said, I had a daughter just that age. I love in my throat. And then he gets out there and plays 2 hours and 45 minutes after a 30 minute sound check when it's like 90 degrees outside. I just couldn't believe it. And I really feel like maybe these guys, even at this age, you know, 80s, well in their 80s now for Ringo, they live to perform still. And they're worth seeing. You know, the ticket price is there, but it was definitely worth it. So that is the main portion of the presentation, just to say Beatlemania is still very much alive and well. This book was an absolute joy to write, and I hope it's reflected in the narrative. But thank you so much for your kind attention. If you have any questions or comments, please let me know. Thank you.
You've been listening to author historian Bob Keeling the book How the Beatles Rocked Florida, presentation he gave last week on April the 13th at the St. Petersburg Museum of History, part of the Happy Hour with the Historian series. Held the second Thursday of each month, the regularly sold-out Happy Hour with the Historian events are evenings of wine, words, and wisdom, featuring a slate of speakers that focus on the unique and unusual history of the Sunshine State. Learn more about the St. Petersburg Museum of History at spmoh.com.